Welcome back, Rhetoric Warriors Podcast. We are cleaning up the world of public discourse. I sometimes call this the Rhetoric Guardians of the Galaxy. Just
I haven't seen any of those movies, so I'll do my best to be a guardian.
First one's awesome. Like, you really should see the first one. Interesting story behind all that. But Rhetoric Warriors Podcast, production of the Ethical Persuasion Institute, which is coming online here pretty soon. I'm Dr. Dan, American rhetorician, late-night comedy writer, Hollywood guy. I live in California. The podcast tries to do a few things. I talk to comedians sometimes about their politics and their careers, interesting visions of the world from those guys. Sometimes I have conservatives on here, and I convert them with all the hidden tools of rhetoric. And I also talk to persuasion pros, rhetoricians, and academics. There's a lot going on in the world, and we need as much information about it as we can get. And that would be today. My guest is an assistant professor in the Department of Journalism and Creative Media. I always like the fact that these departments have to stretch so far to figure out how to describe themselves these days. At the University of Alabama, he has a PhD in American Studies from NYU, specializes in studying the right, the news of the right, and conservative media in general. In other words, he's in the jungle. So it's AJ Bauer.
Born in the jungle, living in the jungle.
Are you from Texas? Where are you from?
I am, yeah. So I'm from a town called Flower Mound, which is just north of Dallas, kind of close to Denton.
Flower Mound, Texas.
Flower Mound. There's a literal mound in the town.
Well, you know, they're not really stretching their aesthetics to get their names, I've noticed. Like a lot of places like Red River. Well, there you go. It's red. I mean,
it's better than White Settlement, which is another North Texas suburban town name, which has a very aggressive connotation. Flower Mound is nice otherwise.
Yeah, I did stand up once in Whiteville, North Carolina, and I'm like, yeah, you guys nailed it. This seems about right.
Yeah, there's a town in Alabama called Clanton, which I'm like, okay, it sounds scary. I mean, I don't know if that's the origin of the meaning of the name, but it doesn't sound very welcoming.
Yeah, I did a deep dive once going through all the weird names on the Rand McNally map of the United States. And like, there's a Hitler. Was there a Hitler? Town named Hitler? Or was Adolf?
Like Hitler, Tennessee or something like that?
Yeah, it was like straight up. And I'm like, oh, okay. But there's also a Santa Claus, Indiana, so that balances out. Yeah.
Hitler and Santa Claus, I don't know. We can talk about the connections. Big government, totalitarians, big facial hair.
Yeah, one of them was much more into facial hair. I always wondered, like, how evil would Hitler have been with a full mustache?
Or a full beard. I don't know that he could grow a full beard, honestly.
I don't know.
You know who would have looked good with a full beard is Stalin, though, because Stalin was actually kind of hot when he was young, although he might have been patchy, too.
We'll rate the attractiveness of all the dictators, like just sort of move down the line. Who's top? I guess, I don't know.
Stalin.
Easy. So, yeah, run your background a little bit. I know you went to UT Austin and then you jumped over to NYU. So just sort of set your background a little bit.
Sure. Yeah. So let me start at the beginning. So I grew up in North Texas, son of conservatives. My mother used to listen to Rush Limbaugh religiously, as did I. I was a big, Reagan, Bush era young conservative. And by young, I mean like actually in elementary school, like a child. And I used to listen to Rush Limbaugh. I cried when George H.W. Bush lost to Bill Clinton in 92, went and got the newspaper and came in and wept. At the headline, I was a big Dole Kemp fan in 1996, like had their stickers all over my wall and stuff. I started kind of shifting my own political orientation end of the 90s, early aughts mostly, got kind of, we could say, radicalized by the Iraq War, which, you know, I found unjustified and confusing as a time period, given that it was so, both the Democratic and Republican parties were kind of in lockstep pushing this war that to me seemed like had no real evidentiary basis for it. And so from there, I just, you know, started reading a little more critically. Shout out to Rage Against the Machine. They're on Evil Empire, which is an album that was a very influential one for me. They had a list of books in it. And so I would go to my used bookstore in Flower Mound, Half Price Books, and which is a little chain Texas area. And I would go and try to find all the books on the on that list and read as much as I can. And so that helped, got a little bit more lefty politics. I wanted to be a journalist, though. So in college, I wasn't really all that much into expressing or in political activism, more or less. I was the editor of the student newspaper, The Daily Texan, at the University of Texas. I went and initially wanted to kind of work in journalism. My first job out of college was at the Patriot Ledger, which is on the South Shore of Massachusetts. I was a business reporter covering small businesses and other kind of market trends. And then the financial crisis happened of 2008. So I had trouble finding work. You know, I found little small and make ends meet jobs. I did freelance journalism in the Boston area, and I applied to grad school. So I ended up going to New York University, which has a wonderful program in American Studies in the Department of Social and Cultural Analysis. I got a master's degree thinking I was going to go back into journalism, but you know, it turns out I was not bad at academic stuff, and decided to stick around. So I ended up getting my PhD there as well. I started the PhD program at NYU in 2011, which was an auspicious time to start. That was when Occupy Wall Street happened. And so my first semester of grad school, I also spent kind of researching part of a kind of collectively written book about the Occupy movement that came out that December and with OR Press, and then came out again with Haymarket the following year. So that book is called, it used to be called, what is it? Occupying Wall Street, right? So I helped write and edit and research that book. And so, you know, politics on the left. But I, you know, my research was engaged in right-wing politics, basically. So I've done ethnographic research. I did 2 months of embedded ethnographic research with the Tea Party movement in 2010. I wrote a master's thesis on that. And then I've since been shifting more gears more towards historical work, although I still dabble in contemporary stuff. So a lot of my work is archival historical research, looking at the long history of conservative media criticism in the United States, but also doing more contemporary stuff. So interviewing conservative journalists as part of a Tau Center report a few years ago about their kind of news judgment and standards. So I kind of dabble in a bunch of different methods, dabble in kind of historical and contemporary politics, mostly just interested and invested in cultivating kind of interdisciplinary subfield around the study of right-wing media and conservative news, both in the United States and around the world.
Good summary.
Thanks.
It was very smooth. Like you started where you started, and then you just easily moved all the way through your entire life, just like that.
I mean, you know, I lived it, so it's been a smooth sailing.
That's one of the things I like about American studies and cultural studies, those kind of backgrounds, they are so broken open and interdisciplinary, because, you know, partially because they came in late, you know, as disciplines, but they're so open. And that's also what I always enjoyed about rhetoric. At least I came from a fairly traditional rhetoric background at UT Austin, and then went to University of South Florida for my PhD, and they were wide open. They didn't know what they were doing. They would let you do anything. Mm-hmm. And so I always had that sort of, you know, like just go and poach. Just find the interesting theories and pull it in.
Yeah, it's that. And then for me too, like, I don't know, I still get itchy and want to interview people sometimes. You know, I was going to be a journalist and now I'm not. And so sometimes I actually just want to go like report again, you know. And one of the benefits of cultural studies is it lets you do both, right? So if I had gone and done a PhD in history, which my undergrad was in history and government, so I could have gone and done a PhD in history if I wanted to. But then I'd be having to write history books forever, right? And don't get me wrong, I really enjoy writing history, but I also want to be able to write about contemporary stuff. And so I've been, one of the benefits of going into journalism as a field, journalism studies out of cultural studies, is like I can kind of write about, you know, whatever method I want, as long as it's engaging within the topic. So yeah, it's been a good place to land.
Yeah, and I read your counter obituary about Rush Limbaugh. And one of the things I've always sort of, you know, had this multiple comedian, comedy writer, stand-up, Semi-academic. I'm not really an academic, more of an intellectual who dabbles. But and then rhetoric and bringing those things together, like finding something like a counter obituary. It's sort of, you know, like Hunter S. Thompson's obituary of Nixon, you know, just destroying Nixon, you know, days after he dies. And comedy gives you all those permissions, right? In fact, that's the expectation. If you're going to take the moment to write, you need to do something, you know, a little bit explosive, a little entertaining. And it's nice to see finding, you know, spaces like that, like you have with the counter obituaries that still have an academic feel to them, but, you know, also have a nice entertainment angle.
Yeah, you know, I one of the reasons I really like doing those or have done a couple, the first one, both of them basically came out of tweets. Like I made like a tweet and then I know colleagues through various, you know, intellectual networks at Abusable Past, at the Radical History Review. And they reached out and they're like, hey, like there's this tradition that we used to run these like counter obituaries that are kind of counterintuitive. You know, do you want to take a shot? So it was, you know, I, as much as I would like to take credit for the counter obituary or whatever, it was kind of, it was an invitation really. And, I, you know, I enjoy it. I think the thing with Limbaugh that is interesting about that as a counter obituary is, you know, most mainstream obituaries of Limbaugh didn't hold any punches. Like, you know, he was a giant asshole and like a lot of people called him out for it and rightly so. I think what I was trying to do in that piece is more try to, and this is kind of emblematic of my overall approach to understand, to research is, you know, I have a sharp tongue. Like I can critique everybody and anybody that I want. I think that criticism and judgment are easy to me. The thing that's harder is understanding, like actually trying to comprehend like why somebody likes or appreciates or supports a certain thing, right? Like it's very easy to say, oh, I disagree with that person, right? It's difficult to be like, all right, well, what's appealing? And one thing I noticed when I was reading a lot of obituaries of Rush Limbaugh were, when you read it, it's like, why did anybody like this guy? Like this guy just seems like a monster and like a horrible person, right? And he was indeed a monster and horrible person, right? But there's a large number of people like his audience, right, who don't see that, like they understand him much differently. And so, you know, my own mother, my own experience listening to Rush Limbaugh growing up, you know, I kind of know why people like him, right? And I think this is something that gets left out a lot. And I just finished writing a piece that's reviewing a couple of new books that's really great that I recommend both. One is Raul Perez's The Souls of White Jokes, which is like maybe the best title of a book I've ever heard, right? Playoff, obviously, of W.B. Du Bois's Souls of White Folks. And then That's Not Funny by Matt Sienkiewicz and Nick Marks. And both of these are attempting to basically say a lot of studies of conservatism have focused on negative affects and emotions, right? Hatred, resentment, you know, negative feelings of repulsion. But what both of those books are getting at, and which I think is the kind of a turn in the field more broadly, is conservatives laugh too. Like they have fun. They enjoy themselves, right? And if we only focus on the negative affects that mobilize them, we run the risk of developing critiques that don't land with conservatives, right? Because conservatives are like, well, you're saying that Rush Limbaugh is an angry, mean guy, but when I listen, I laugh and have levity. It feels good to me. So like, those things don't connect, right? It's like a skewed argument. And so if we want to reach conservatives, and this gets to kind of your project, right? This rhetorical project is not just like, how do we devise a critique that is sharp and accurate, right? But how do we use rhetorical strategies and understanding of our subjects, right? The person that we're trying to reach in a way that we can actually land our critiques. And that's been the project I've been mostly involved with is cultivating, developing those tools of understanding in order to make that next step, right? To do that kind of critical turn and hopefully actually make critiques that land with the people we're critiquing. Because I think a lot of critiques of right-wing media in particular and right-wing more broadly are self-oriented, right? I feel good and virtuous because I've made this critique, right? Look at all these people that are like saying how smart and sharp I am for this critique of right-wing things, right? None of that does anything to disrupt right-wing activism or politics, right? And so for me, I'm much more interested in that. And so my question is, well, to what extent can we devise a critique and critical language that actually lands with right-wingers and conservatives and mitigates, if maybe convinces them, sure, but if not convinces them, at least mitigates the harm? Right.
Yeah, and I totally agree with that. I sometimes describe it as culling the red herd. Like if you're going to, if one of the projects of this is to get as many, you know, hardcore democracy addicts and, you know, people who want to use ethical persuasion and want to have a clean public discourse, you have to go into the other, like just talking to the people who want that does nothing. You have to recruit from the other side. You have to have techniques to go in and retrieve people that have been absorbed into, you know, that way of seeing things. And even with comedy, one of the things I just moved back to California a year ago after my kids both were grown and flown, and I have some projects about trying to get that, because I grew up in Kentucky and my family wasn't very political, but you know, I understand conservative thought. I understand sort of rural thought. I understand, you know, what those communities and cultures, how they receive messages, you know, and like your point about Limbaugh, that there's an aesthetic side of Limbaugh. Coming through Hollywood production, I know how talented these guys are. Like Limbaugh was an incredibly talented broadcaster, told great stories, you know, hit emotional buttons, great voice, all that kind of stuff. And you can't ignore the aesthetics for why it has appeal. And I think you're exactly right. Like a lot of people on the left, when they do comedy, like Colbert or whatever, when they do political comedy, I'm like, yeah, but you're just doing comedy for lefties.
Yeah.
You're not making any inroads. What right. you need is like somebody like Larry the Cable Guy delivery, but slipping in, you know, some more liberal type thoughts into that. So if you can reach into that herd, then you've actually, you know, may have some effect.
Right. Like a liberal Jeff Foxworthy or something, right? Yeah. You might be a redneck, but all the like bad things or whatever are conservative and good things are liberal or whatever. Yeah, I mean, my colleague Reese Peck, who's at CUNY Staten Island and wrote this great book called Fox Populism, is very much invested in that project, right? Like, what does it look like to contest politically, right, in the realm of white working class culture, right? How do you go about reaching these corners of society and of culture that have been more or less captured aesthetically and culturally by the right, because the right has been fixated on, you know, supporting or reorienting itself around country music, for example, or, you know, rally around the flag and like football culture, or like we're seeing right now with the gas stove thing, right? Like every year there's another, like, they're coming for your burgers, right? And, you know, all of that is designed to appeal to that kind of like middle brow, you know, white coated working class culture. And you know, I agree that there are ways that rhetorically we can do better at appealing to those circles. I also think it's fine for comedians like Colbert or whoever to like have left and liberal audiences, and like we need levity too. You know, like I don't think we need to all be orienting all of our energy around trying to convert conservatives or something. I think that for me the you know, I'm of the perspective that it's impossible to ever, quote unquote, win the broader struggle that we're having, right? We're never going to get rid of conservatism. It will always exist. The more important thing is to mitigate its harms and to relegate it to a position where it won't achieve power, right? And so that is a numbers game to some extent, right? Getting enough people who are liberal or lefty, or at least like going to vote towards democratic principles or something like that.
Yeah, and I think, you know, you make a point, I think, in a lot of your work about how the right has built an architecture, a media architecture underneath this in order to propagate a certain type of messaging or to attach to a certain type of messaging with country music and everything like that. And I agree, like the left, you know, most of Hollywood is left. You know, I worked for Dennis Miller for a couple of years after he'd turned into a right-wing zealot. But 90% of the staff had been with him on HBO when he was a liberal prince. And the whole writing staff is super liberal. And we would just write whatever, as long as it had a bite to it, he'd be fine. And he would add the ugliness, you know, wherever he wanted to. Mm-hmm. But it's not so much trying to change what Hollywood's doing, but I think there's a play for the liberal Democrats to do some outreach, you know, through entertainment into those herds. Like, even if you were producing, there's some really great sort of Southern hardcore conservative entertainers, storytellers, comics, and things like that, who are liberal, mm-hmm. you know, but they have all the affectation of that, you know, that the right would be okay with. They wear cowboy hats and they sound like that. and giving them a different message, you know, they can import it in because they seem safe, I think, to the right, you know, because they have the right aesthetics.
Yeah. And I mean, I also think it's just like creating space for different, like the acceptability of different ways of being in aesthetics as well, right? Like, I think that we often talk about political conflict, like there are conservatives and there are liberals and they fight one another. But like, most people are neither of those things. They're just like people, and they don't really think that much about politics because they got other things to focus on, right? They are raising kids or they're working or whatever, right? It doesn't matter. Because the journalism industry is tanked, right? They don't really have that many local news sources. Like maybe they've got like a Sinclair-owned ABC station, and then they see Fox or something, and that gives them ideas about the world outside of their immediate experience, right? And what ideas they have access to is either going to incline them towards more conservatism or more liberalism, right? And I think that I'm less concerned with debating, right, conservatives and trying to win them over. It's more a matter of like, well, how do we make left politics salient and acceptable and normative for folks who don't really pay that close of attention? And I think that that's really where conservatives are more successful than liberals, is that they're not trying to win over liberals. They don't care. They're trying to win over people who are like low information voters, who are not really, or maybe not even voters, but maybe some they will be voters, right? This whole like natural gas stove thing is a perfect example, right? As was the like, they're coming for your burgers example from last year, 2 years ago or whatever, right? If I don't pay that close of attention to politics, and all of a sudden I've got somebody saying, did you hear the Democrats want to take away your stove? I'm gonna be like, what? I love my stove, right? I cook all the time. And then that's gonna mobilize me, right? And so I don't think that there's any real trick to it. I think it's just a matter of like reconsidering what audience you're engaged with. Like a lot of liberals are like trying to frame their arguments to win over conservatives. Conservatives are not playing that game. They're playing a different game.
Right. Yeah, I totally drag people out of logos, you know, instantly. I'm like, there's no reason for us to do logic here. Like, No. Like the left loves logic. It loves to be rational. It loves evidence. It loves, you know, complicated claim architecture. And I'm like, none of that, just drop it, because it's never going to work. Like when I talk to conservatives on the podcast, anytime they try to drag me into the squid nest of, you know, logical argument, I'm like, that's not what we're going to, there's no place for us to go there. You know, so I just usually use story. You know, I'll just wander over to mythos. And I'm like, well, tell me, like you did at the beginning, how did you get into the right? You know, Where did it come from? And it's usually a family, you know, entree.
Yeah. No, I think stories are very impactful and powerful. And, you know, like Arlie Hochschild's book, Strangers in Their Own Land, talks about it. My colleague Tony Nadler talks about it in his work. Like stories have some reason to them. Like sometimes there's logic involved in stories, but it isn't reducible to that, right? And I think that some conservatives do like play the logic game in ways that the left doesn't do, right? So like I think about like Ben Shapiro, right? Which is like, you know, almost a parody of logicality, right? It's like, it doesn't actually make sense, but it has a kind of an aesthetic of logic to it. You know, it's a, what do they call it? Enthymeme, right? Mm-hmm. But I think that, I hear you about like the left. I think that it's less the left. And I mean, although there are like some corners of like, I don't know, Marxist thought that are like very logical or oriented around like materialist thinking. But I don't know. I come from like a tradition of more like, I don't know if it's like anarchist leftists or something, but like there's always a little bit of an appreciation of absurdity and surrealism, right? Like a lot of with Occupy, and Occupy got a lot of critique for this too, of not really having any demands and like being open, but there was a lot of fun there, you know, like, you know, people dressed like clowns, people having these like, actions that had fun and humor and music, and like Reverend Billy, right, who would go around and do these kind of like, what's the word? What do you do when you're trying to get a spirit out of somebody? Like exorcisms of like banks and like commercial stores and stuff like that, right? Like, so there's a sort of like playfulness on the left too, that I think often gets overlooked and certainly gets ignored completely by, you know, right-wing media, who wants, you know, all leftists to be depicted as these kind of like, dour, you know, rule following, you know, disciplinarians. And it's like a good chunk of the left are just weirdos who like having fun and want everybody to be equal.
Yeah. And there are some comedians that were at the Occupy Wall Street stuff, and they did comedy about it and got a little juice here and there, different stand-ups who would go up and talk about it. And because stand-up is really good at absorbing caricatures of whatever, you know, if you can grab the right caricature, Larry the Cable Guy is a great example. Mm-hmm. You know, he's really Dan Whitney from Nebraska. And I brought him up on stage like the third time he ever did Larry the Cable Guy as a character. Mm-hmm. And he came up, he's like, "What did you think?" I'm like, "Well, you're going to be a millionaire. That's ridiculously popular." And but he just grabbed a caricature. And once you grab that caricature, it leads you to script. And that's why I think, like, when I read your thing about Limbaugh, and you're like, "Well, appreciate the aesthetics of what Limbaugh was. They were really good." Mm-hmm. And I'm like, yeah, and that to me is how you should think about maybe importing messaging. Mm-hmm. Like, if you could see the get the right to see that, hey, the left is funny, you know, and it's not always, there's self-deprecation on the left too. Like, it'll make fun of itself and all this stuff. It's just a more elevated type of humor a lot of times than what the right is used to.
Yeah, I mean, I think humor, for me at least, is, and this is another reason why, like, a lot of the focuses on anger, resentment, hatred, et cetera, on the right, I try to push back a little against, isn't, I mean, those things exist. Like, I get in arguments with my family, conservative family members that are in there angry, or, you know, that stuff happens too. But I often, like, the bridge that, like, calms them down and, like, it's whatever is humor. And so, you know, I think I've long been drawn towards, like, humor, not in, like, a, you know, stand-up jokey kind of way, but more just like observational humor or self-deprecation or whatever. It's a good way to, like, create some levity that creates bonds, right? And allows for people to, who may disagree very vehemently about something, to connect. And so, I don't know. I think that there's some role for humor in, I don't know about winning over conservatives, but at least, like, mitigating some of that enmity between, like, left and right, right? Reestablishing that sense of shared humanity that you can then have conversations in.
Yeah, it gives a different reward to the conversation. I have a friend who's very conservative, but she's all over the place. She was super liberal and now she's super conservative, and she's just mutable, you know? And she keeps running for political office in Vermont. And I was talking to her once, I think even on the podcast, and I'm like, this is before the 2020 election. And I said, okay, so how about this? I'll give you a corn dog if you vote for Joe Biden. And she's like, what are you talking about? It's like a really fresh corn dog, like from 7-Eleven, you can get mustard, you know, we'll go down there. And she's like, I'm not trading my constitutional rights for a corn dog. I'm like, it sounds like a pretty good trade, really. I said, well, I'll throw in a slushy, you know? And just because, you know, like with the right sometimes, and the left too, whenever you get a hornet's nest in your head, like, you got to break it up somehow. And comedy can at least put something in there that they can't quite get rid of. You know, she'll think about corn dogs. When she sees corn dogs, she'll think about voting for Joe Biden. And so, you know, all those more, in some ways, more sophisticated techniques that get things into, you know, cloudy brains and storming brains, I think are really useful. That's one of the things I try to teach when I do seminars about, you know, how do you convert the right? Well, mm-hmm. you know, you can't go at them frontally. You can't go in confrontation. They're very triggerable. Everybody's very triggerable. And if you're triggering, you've lost, you know, mm-hmm. you just lost. And so a lot of it's that sort of zen of controlling yourself so that you can use techniques like comedy or like being interpersonally, you know, aware of what you're doing to this person. Not whether you're right or not, doesn't matter, but are you upsetting this person? And why do you think you have the right to do that just because, you know, your politics are, you know, different than theirs? Mm-hmm. And so some of that training, I think, comes in really handy for people when they do try to, you know, sort of up their skills to be able to talk into difficult situations. Mm-hmm. You must have seen tons of that if you were embedded with the Tea Party. Mm-hmm. You must have had to do a lot of Zen work to be around that.
Did a lot of drinking too, which was the problem. So I had to, like, yeah, no, so I, yeah, so it was difficult, right? But yeah, so I think that there was also some ways that I don't know if I use humor to get out of those situations that much. It was more just like going through it. Like the one instance that I think that comes to mind every time I think about my Tea Party experiences was, so I spent a month in Boston, and there it was like Tea Partiers in a liberal environment. And so they felt kind of felt under threat, but they also like had liberal coworkers and yeah, exchanged with them. And so like when I was there, they just assumed I was liberal because I was from NYU. And so they were like, oh yeah, liberal. Okay, whatever. We'll talk to you and try to convince you and try to win you over. Right. When I got to Texas though, a lot of those folks don't have any liberals in their lives, right? Like they don't know what a liberal is basically. And so, you know, I showed up to the area that I was from, which is a very conservative area. And I went to the first Tea Party meeting of that month that I was there in North Texas there. And it was at an IHOP in Carrollton, Texas, which is North Dallas suburb, kind of a middle-class suburb. You know, it's near kind of a more affluent suburb of Plano, near some other like less, you know, less like more working class suburbs as well. But anyway, so I show up at this IHOP and I introduced myself to the leader of the group or whatever. I was like, oh, thanks for, you know, telling me about this. I'm happy to, you know, let me know if you want me to introduce myself or whatever. And so he's like, okay. And like goes off, has the whole meeting. And then at the very end, he says, oh, that's right. AJ Bauer is here. He's visiting us from New York University and he's studying us. And so, you know, he wanted to let us know that if we want to get interviewed to like talk to him. And he was like, hey, why don't you come up here and, you know, introduce yourself. And so I got up there and I was like, oh, hi, you know, I'm AJ. I grew up like 10 miles from here in Flower Mound. Like I'm, you know, doing research as part of this project at NYU. And in my head, I was like, do I tell them my politics or do I not? Like that was something that was going on in the back of my head. And I start to see them kind of like getting a little itchy. And like, there was one woman in particular who like jutted her hand up and I was like, okay. So I said, you know, I grew up conservative. Now I'm on the left, but you know, I'm still interested in like how and why conservatives think the way they do, et cetera, et cetera. So the woman who juts her hand up, I call on her. I wasn't planning on taking questions, but I'm like, okay, sure. And she says, I was in California once and I met some liberals there, right? Which if you're from Texas, you know, California is like with liberalism for them, right? So she said, there were some liberals there. And I asked them, and they told me that they hate America and that they want to destroy America. So on behalf of the left, why do you want to destroy America? And like she asked this to me, like in front of other Tea Partiers in an IHOP, you know, whatever. And so I was like, well, you know, I don't know that I can speak for the whole left, but I also don't know any leftists who want to destroy America. Like we're, that's not the goal. And like was kind of talking, whatever, laughing it off. But what ends up happening was afterwards, I got the most interview volunteers from like any other meeting that I went to the whole time I was studying them, because people were embarrassed. They were like, I'm so sorry, that was so rude. Like, here's my phone number, call me, like we'll do an interview. And I ended up getting like a half dozen interviews out of it. And so I think that that's an interesting thing, right? Because part of what happened there is there was somebody who was very stereotypical, actually, in the way that she conveyed her conservatism and accused me or attacked me in a public meeting. But like, there was also a lot of people that were like, this was too far, right? This was like not an appropriate way of expressing oneself. And so I always think about that because it's like, to some extent, it plays into stereotypical understandings of what the Tea Party was like, but it ended up also producing some like really counterintuitive or non-stereotypical responses too. And I think that that's the way that most politics ends up being, like when you're interacting with it, like actually engaged with it, right? Not just studying it kind of abstractly or reading books about it. Like if you're in, you know, a diner with people who have different politics from you, like it's all kind of trial and error, and people have different, you know, people are different and have different motivations and different desires for expressing themselves. So anyway, I forget what the question was. I went off on a tangent. Apologies.
Oh, that was right. I asked you what it was like being embedded with the party.
Yeah. Hold up. It was weird.
Yeah, I have a buddy who's a comic in Louisville, and he got fascinated by the Tea Party movement there because it was pretty active and pretty public in Louisville. And so, you know, he spent a long time, you know, around those people. And again, if you've grown up around that, it doesn't feel that crazy. It doesn't feel that dangerous. You're like, okay, my grandmother was just as nuts as this. And I know pretty much how far it's going to go. I think people who never have any experience with like evangelical Christians, for example, they just look at it and go, it's so foreign that they just have no way of interacting with it. Mm-hmm. My grandmother was Southern Baptist, and she used to take us to church when we would go stay over there. And I remember once they were calling people down to be saved, like who hadn't been saved. I was maybe seven. My grandmother just kind of bumped me out of the pew, to try to make me go down there. And I'm like, I'm not going down there. Like, that's crazy town. Mm-hmm. But I knew what it was. And, so you do, you have a different way of interpreting a lot of that stuff where you don't just take it to the extreme. You're like, it's not exactly what they mean. They're saying this, but it's really just they haven't processed anything beyond, liberal in California, that must be all liberals.
Right. Or they're getting messages from the media that they're reading and consuming that tells them that this is the way to behave, and that this is the way that liberals think. Because again, they don't actually interact that much with it. Like we, in addition to kind of like, there's all this conversation about polarization, which is kind of a misnomer. It's more of like right-wing radicalization and asymmetrical polarization. But there is like geographical polarization to some extent, in the sense that there are geographies of conservatism and more left or liberal thinking where you don't always come across people who disagree from you, right, or disagree with you. A lot of churches in particular, right, are either racially segregated, especially, but also ideologically, right, politically, ideologically. Like there are here in Tuscaloosa, there's a liberal church. Only one that I know of for sure, but like at least one, like good progressive liberal church, a lot of others that are like more apolitical, and then some that are like more overtly conservative, right? And so the way that we organize ourselves socially, in terms of where we physically live, in terms of what communities we choose or choose to live in terms of what churches we go to within the communities we choose to live in, all of these things self-select us according to political ideology often. And so, there's a lot of ways that this often gets blamed on social media, right? This kind of like, oh, it's all filter bubbles and echo chambers, and you're just self-selecting into the media you like. But that also happens in like lived interactive reality too. And I think to some extent, when somebody is used to those kind of narratives about like what difference is like that they hear about in their media consumption, and then they're faced with difference in real life, there's two types of people, right? One is going to respond based upon the cues of that, media that they're consuming, which sometimes can land flat, like the woman who asked me those questions did. Other people are like, I'm in a room with this person. Like, even if we disagree, like we've got this like shared humanity. I can see them. I can see their chest going up from breathing, right? Like they're a human being in the room with me, right? And that's somewhat different than, shit posting on Twitter or something where you may feel like you're talking to a bot or something.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Like the church thing, there's a comedian friend of mine named Tom Simmons, and he's a Southerner. There are three Southern comics that go around. Something like the liberal rednecks of the South or liberal Southern thinkers. And they're all, deep, deep South, like Alabama and Georgia, and he's from North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And they, they go around basically not to attack the right, but to show like there is some plethora of thought here. And he had a project for a while when he would go to a new town, he would find the most extreme conservative church. Mm-hmm. And he would go there to a service and he would live tweet the service. I call it pew tweets. And just how people were losing their minds around him, like, what are you doing? He's like, I think this guy's interesting, I'm just tweeting about it so my friends can read it. Mm-hmm. And they threw him out, and he was threatened a bunch of times and all this stuff, because again, like that's an apparent behavior, like that's unusual.
Yeah,
everybody behaves like this in this space. How you can't bring somebody in doing something different without sort of blowing it open.
Well, and that's like almost a metaphor for what I was talking about earlier, right? Which is that, there are all these forms and strategies of critique that have been cultivated outside of engagement or interaction with conservatives, right? Either like Marxist criticisms, various other forms of critical theory, right? that have explanations for why conservatives feel and think the way that they do. These are more or less abstract. They are theoretical. They are not rooted in interaction or conflict, actual conflict. And so part of what I think is important is understanding, right? So that the critique, whatever you're doing, lands in the context that it lands in, right? And so, for example, your friend or whoever this was who goes to some, you know, conservative church and then like acts a fool, right? If you go there, you know what's already going on in that church. You understand the kind of repertoires and cultural expectations and practices of that space. You can riff on those things in subversive ways, right? In ways that reach people possibly, or at least like, you know, reaches them kind of where they're at. Versus I'm going to take this alien form, right? This like version of critique or this version of cultural practice. I'm going to impose it on a space that is unfamiliar with it, right? The lack of familiarity itself is going to cause friction, right? So if you get rid of that, you manage to find that familiarity, that friction goes away. And then you're back in a place where you can actually play with people's ideas a bit. I deal with this all the time with my students when I'm teaching, right? It's like, you know, I'm not coming in and just like introducing wild ideas that they've never heard of before, right? And expecting them to like appreciate and understand them. It's like finding out where they're at and then riffing and you know, improvising on top of that so that they can get a little bit closer to this other place that I want them to get, right? And so you've got to understand and know the culture and the area that you're trying to land a critique in order to actually reach the people in the first place.
Yeah, and that's my two worlds of moving back when I used to teach, moving through academics and then back into stand-up, because I was doing both. At night, I would go to comedy clubs, and the day I would teach, and just making sure I was in the right idiom, you know, to respond in the right setting. So like students, I remember I taught at Peace College in Raleigh, North Carolina, which had been a finishing school for girls for 120 years, and then was trying to move into some type of a little liberal arts college. In theory. And I was teaching a cultural studies course and we were doing, you know, origin myths. I started talking about the Adam and Eve myth and I might as well just dropped a bomb in the, you know, in the middle of the room. It's like, what do you mean myth?
Yeah. Like, you mean the very beginning of history?
So I think we've defined myth. Like you guys remember the definition, which is it doesn't matter really whether it's true or not. It's what does it, you know, sort of fuel the culture to do. Mm-hmm. And they're like, well, what do you, you know, I literally got the, well, what do you believe in? Evolution. Mm-hmm. I'm like, it's not really a belief system. It's if you believe in science and this is the conclusion of science, then you can't pick and choose, mm-hmm. you know, with science. Like, you know, I'm not a scientist, but I typically think that's a good set of answers for things. Mm-hmm. But, you know, trying to walk your way through that minefield, sometimes I call it wearing clown shoes in the minefield. You know, you're, in comedy, you're going out to explode those minds. And I have a whole stand-up show that is nothing but politics. And I start and tell everybody I'm going to do nothing but politics for the next hour. And I'm not going to offend anybody because I believe everything. And I think everybody's right. Like, I think we should build a wall. You know, it should be 100 feet tall and it should have flypaper. And so, you know, it should have video set up so we can watch people get stuck and, you know, just sort of take everything and amplify it, you know, as a comedy technique mm-hmm. and tell people they're not conservative enough. Mm-hmm. And they have no argument for that. They've never been told that they aren't conservative enough. And so in the comedy space, it works. But in the education space, they were not ready for me to do comedy. And they reported me to the president of the elder Presbyterian of the church.
Yikes. Pretty funny. Yeah, no, I mean, I teach a critical race theory lesson in my media law class every semester. It's a essay from the book from, I think, a 1993 book called Words That Wound. And it's like a really interesting essay that's like using critical race theory to think about the First Amendment and to think about speech codes, right? Like, so obviously in the United States, the Supreme Court has been very opposed to speech codes and to restrictions on hate speech. But what the essay does is it looks at Brown versus Board as a speech case, basically, right? Like, yeah, you're, you know, saying something about public accommodations, but part of that is like signage. It's like letting people know whether they can or can't stay, right? So in some ways it is regulating speech, right? It's regulating speech with a certain kind of like physical consequence to it. But anyway, every semester I teach that, and every semester I have students who are you know, mad about it, opposed to it or whatever. And I'll raise it up. And sometimes the conservative students in class will kind of argue with me about it, and that's fine. But at the end of class, what my like go away takeaway line is always, well, we just talked about critical race theory for 75 minutes and nobody died. So I guess it's not that scary. Right. And like, am I convincing all 120 of those students to be like critical race theorists? No, not at all. Right. But like, are they going off into the world now? And like, if they hear somebody talking about it, they're like, oh, actually, like what you're saying isn't anything like this kind of really dense legal analysis that I read in class, right? You're talking about this kind of like weird boogeyman thing, but like that's different than this thing I experienced. And just creating that dissonance in their heads is already creating critical thought, right? That's going to help, right? So it isn't even a matter of like indoctrination or anything like that. It's just like introducing people to things that are outside their comfort zone and helping them feel more comfortable with it, right? That they can understand it. It isn't this alien concept that's like hurting them or someone, right? It's just like another idea that they can take or leave. Hopefully they take, but.
Well, that's why I've always really attached to rhetoric theory, because rhetoric essentially is mechanistic. Like it doesn't care what you talk about. It cares about the mechanism with which you talk. And so like that, the fact that, you know, we can drop anything into the mechanism of professor taking people through, you know, a particular set of ideas. That's a rhetorical challenge, right? And you know that you learn structures for doing it and how to stay meta and how not to attack people for their wrong ideas within it. And but it's totally mechanistic. And a lot of times when I talk to conservatives, if I can get them into an intellectualized space a little bit and pull them up into the meta, and I'll be like, it's okay to, you know, completely disagree. What's not okay is for us to break interpersonal connections as we do that, you know? And so I want to make sure that I take care of you in this conversation. If you start to get upset, you know, let's talk about it. Let's make sure that we do the work, the conversational work that keeps us in a positive relationship. And I tell people a lot of times, I see this when my daughter went to North Texas for 2 years, and then she couldn't take it anymore. So she transferred to France and finished there. But she was on campus, and like the first week, you know, Christians were trying to convert her, and there were Christians darkening on campus. And she's like, I had this big argument with these older Christians who came on campus today. And I'm like, well, what was your point of arguing? And she's like, well, they just made me mad. They, you know, they were yelling and, you know, accusing us of this stuff. And I'm like, well, if your purpose was to change them or have some effectiveness, then you go rhetoric. If you want to be expressive and just be like, you pissed me off and now I'm going to attack you as best I can, then do that, you know, but the mechanism itself is there for you, you know, and I did some little sub trainings with her so she would have some of those things in her repertoire, but it's bloodless, right? It's absolutely agnostic. It doesn't care whether you're right or left. Mm-hmm. It just cares how you do the mechanism well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that, I don't know, I'm of a few minds on this. Like, I obviously am a person in the world who engages in conversation and debate and discussion and all those sorts of things, and so use rhetoric all the time. I also think I'm increasingly like, so the idea of rhetorical strategy in politics suffers from a couple of things, two things in particular. One is scalability, right? How are you going to, like, if you're talking about like individual conversations, understanding or whatever, how are you going to scale that, right? The other thing is, and this is why I'm drawn, I think, more to discourse than to rhetoric, is that so much of politics is about what the words that we have, the concepts we have, allow us to understand about the world and what they prevent us from understanding, right? What we're capable of knowing and what, you know, language and culture or whatever prevents us from knowing, right? And I think that this is where I've been coming down a lot on this lately, is I've been thinking a lot about there's like a trend. And I think you had Jen Senko on your podcast at some point. And I know her documentary and her book are very invested in this, which is, you know, what's it called? Like Losing My Dad or something. What was it called again?
The Brainwashing of My Dad.
Right. Brainwashing in particular. Right. And so like this whole parental loss narrative that's been really prevalent in the last, say, 5, 10 years, right? Of like, oh, I lost my parents to QAnon, or I lost my dad to Donald Trump, or whatever, right? Who's to say they're lost and we're not lost? So, for example, like when my mother died a few years ago, and I remember having these conversations with her as she was dying, like oral history stuff. And I remember asking her, I was like, well, how does it feel to have like a lefty son? And she's like, oh, I don't care that much. I mean, like, I obviously hoped that you would be conservative and tried to raise you that way, but who knows what happened to you, right? And part of what that got for me is like, and she was like, I always knew that you'd use your mouth for something in career, and you're just using it different than I thought you would, or whatever. And so part of what I got from that is I was like, she sees me as the lost one, right? Like,
sure.
And so it's entirely perspectival, right? And like, one of my problems with the discourse of parental laws is it implies a responsibility in children for the politics of their parents. And to me, that's kind of a corollary of the responsibility parents supposedly have for the indoctrination of their children, right? And so if I want to say that I think that it's fucked that conservative families reinforce and perpetuate racism, homophobia, sexism in their children, and perpetuate those systems of oppression through the way they raise their children, right? And then I think there's a responsibility of those children to break out of that, like to enlighten themselves, find a way out of that, right? Then turning that around, like the whole purpose of the familial relationship around politics is a guilt relation to keep me in line, right? Oh, well, you're a liberal now. Well, I'm a conservative and you're my son. And so you must also be conservative. And that you've not been a conservative anymore is, it shows poorly on your filial piety, right? Your ability to be a good child to me, right? So all the parental loss discourse does, it just flips it on its head, which is to say, oh no, you're a bad parent for not having raised me in the political ideology that I wish you had raised me in. Both of these to me strike me as toxic. They don't seem terribly useful in one regard or the other. And so what I've come down to, and this gets back to this question of discourse versus rhetoric, is like both of those are premised on rhetoric. Like they're going to convince you of this, or you're going to convince them of that, or you're going to save them through other counter brainwashing or whatever. What I think is more interesting is how do we build a world where right-wing ideas don't make sense? They're disorienting. They don't resonate with people. Like we live in a society right now where racism, sexism, homophobia have become so ingrained in the culture and so naturalized in certain cultural contexts that it seems like if you say something that isn't sexist, right, that there's like a dissonance there, right? And it makes it harder for it to resonate in that community. How do we change that dynamic, right? And changing that dynamic doesn't mean like having a fight with my parents. It means organizing my workplace, like organizing my neighborhood, making it so there's spaces where young people and old people can come across different ideas that are not racist, sexist, homophobic, etc. From my own experience, like I have a lot of friends who grew up in New York and talk about these great, like, you know, anarchist info shops and things like that, that they were able to go to, where, you know, they were able to go to like queer bars and nightclubs and things and experience. When I grew up in North Texas, in the run-up to the Iraq War during the George W. Bush administration, before we had internet, really. I mean, we had like dial-up, but like you couldn't call if your mom was on the phone. You had to wait till she got off the phone, like all these kind of things, right? I couldn't find any of that. Like, where am I going to find? How am I going to know? What am I going to know to Google search for, right? If I want to look up lefty ideas. This is why getting back at this idea of Rage Against the Machine earlier, like they had literally a book list in their thing. And I bought that at like a Blockbuster Music or something like that, right? So like, how do we get subversive, progressive, anti-racist, anti-homophobic, anti-sexist ideas to people, students, young people, old people, in areas where those ideas are not resonant, right? Where they're intrusive. Now, the internet has created more space for this. It's easier, but you still need to know what to search for, right? So I don't know, those bigger questions, right? How do we build an infrastructure that is more amenable or resonant to progressive ideas, right? I think is crucial, because right now what we've got is a broader cultural infrastructure that's designed to bolster hierarchies of oppression. And outside of breaking that structure down, we're always going to be fighting a losing battle if we're just using rhetoric, right? Because we're running up against that resonance of right-wing reactionary ideas. So this is what draws me to these kind of bigger questions of, you know, media systems and infrastructure.
Yeah, and I have a bigger definition of rhetoric than most people. I think rhetoric is really the design of any of these issues that play into public discourse. You know, it's clearly the application of these things to do, you know, influence work, but it's also, you can't really understand the way rhetoric works unless you look at something like the entire ecology in which it's operating. It's silly to say, well, better arguments will win. I'm like, no, like Trump, I think, showed up, you know, when he showed up and broke politics, with one of the ways he did it was importing entertainment technique, you know, very clear reality show entertainment structures, narrative structures, hyper conflict, claim only, you know, discourse with no evidence, all these things which are in, you know, built into that system. And he had been trained into it for a long time. I tell people a lot of times, I'm like, there's no other Trump coming. Like, you may get other right wingers, but you've not had somebody that's lived inside of, you know, the Hollywood system, maybe The Rock or somebody who's going to come back out and try. But he has skills to run script, that disciplined script that nobody else has. Like, it's amazed me that Trump has never used all the words. You know, the discipline that takes is, you know, it's a professional actor. He stays on script. And, you know, sort of seeing that stuff imported through entertainment, I'm like, well, you know, quit playing the traditional grandiose, you know, idealism political rhetoric, like even Biden does a lot. You know, here's our greatest ideals and we need to live up to them. And start playing some entertainment games, because that's what the right, you know, the right is oscillating through these things that you're not even using. And so I think you're right. I think, you know, looking at the ecology and seeing what's actually happening there is important if you're going to be a rhetorician too. Like, you can't just import like this sort of civic tradition. I got a buddy who just wrote a book about the end of civility or beyond civility. And he's still in the rhetorical tradition. That's one of the reasons why I got out of academics, I think, is it just felt constraining. And I'm like, eh, I get it. I think all that stuff's great and great speeches, but you're looking at a much more dynamic world right now and you have to adjust this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I would just push back and say, I don't think Donald Trump broke politics. I think politics has been politics and it stays politics. I think politics is perpetual and never ending, and that nobody can break it.
Well, I think for Americans, you know, this sort of very, you know, last 10% of our energy that we use for politics, to see that upended and suddenly politics right in your face 24/7. I had a friend when I was in school in Florida who had been in Bay of Pigs. It, you know, came here from Cuba on a raft. Mm-hmm. And he told me once, he's like, yeah, you guys don't, and you don't understand. This is not politics. Nobody's dying. Nobody's grabbing somebody in the middle of the night. You don't know politics at all. Mm-hmm. And so for Americans to at least have that forced up more towards the surface, you're just watching everybody just break. It's like, oh my God, I got to get away from politics. I'm like, well, good luck. I don't think we're going back.
Politics has always been here. It's always been everywhere. Like, the thing is that I agree with you that there's been a narrative that politics is like constrained to some little corner of our psyche or discourse, but like, that is a gigantic privilege.
Oh, sure.
Right. Like, yeah. For most people, politics is like breathing. Like, you have to, you can't not do engage in politics and in conflict, right? Like, queer people, Black people, women, right? Like, the, How do you live a life as a queer person or as a Black person or as a woman without thinking and engaging in politics in every single day? You don't, right? And so, like, there's a way that the idea that politics is something that only certain people do, and only certain people do when they've got a certain kind of like interest or something, I don't know. I mean, maybe this is me being contrarian, but I would rather more people be invested and interested in politics than less. And I think that if Trump's breaking of politics meant extending politics more broadly, like creating space, like making things that people thought were apolitical, recognize that they're political, I think he did us a service.
No,
And
I
now, don't get me wrong, I
completely
disagree with Trump on literally everything. But like, I think that if we delude ourselves to thinking that any aspect of social and cultural life is not political, then we're deluding ourselves. And we always have been.
Oh, for sure. I completely agree that, it's an entitled position to just say, I don't have to care about politics and my life's still pretty good. It's like, yeah, that's an illusion. And, when the the capitalist structure came for the piggy bank of the middle class by taking all the houses, and suddenly you're like, wait a minute, what's happened? I'm like, well, politics is what happened. You allowed, these financial structures to exist, and look what's happened to your culture. And I think some of that stuff, when it has sort of welled up into the comfortable middle class and people that, thought they didn't have to take care of politics or pay attention, it probably is a good thing eventually,
I mean, I also think that we need to rethink what we think of as politics, right? I think that a lot of people associate that with parties, right? It was like, oh, I got to join the Democratic Party or Republican Party or DSA or whatever, right? People just need to organize their workplaces and organize their friends and neighbors. Like, you need to like actually talk about issues of consequence with people in your lives. That doesn't mean like getting in debates with conservatives if you're a liberal or whatever, but it means like knowing the politics of everybody who's a neighbor of you. Like, if you live in an apartment building, you should know everybody on your floor's politics because you should talk about politics with them. Like, if you're in a friend group, you should know the politics of everybody in your friend group because you should talk about politics with them. Like, if you work in a workplace, you should know the politics of all your coworkers because you talk about politics with them. Like, this should be like the air that we breathe. And I think that a lot of times people think about politics as being this, like, being only about conflict and only about approaching people with whom you disagree. But equally or arguably more important is building solidarity and connection with people with whom you do agree. So that you know if there's some issue or some problem, or the boss is cutting, not paying people well, or some other coworker is harassing someone, right? That you have that community there to do something about it when it needs to be done. But you can't cobble that together in a crisis, right? You need to be doing that organizing work always so that when a crisis comes up, then you're like, hey, I know 12 people who got my back on this. I'm going to call them up. We're going to get together, organize something, right? And so I think if the Trump era has taught us anything, is that politics is everywhere. If it's taught us anything else, it's that it's very easy if we're only using this kind of nationalized, mediated form of politics to get extremely burnt out and tired of politics, right? One thing that will help reinvigorate political life is direct connections between human beings about the things that matter to them, both their interests and their kind of aesthetic preferences, like what they want in life and town. And so I don't know. I think that less debate, less conflictual argumentation, more conversations with people in your community with whom you share ideas and building things, right, from the ground up.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great point. I think some of the basic training, like putting people through boot camp of politics, like where they can get that in their minds, like the two things you said about it's okay to have political conversations. In fact, it's necessary to constantly have political conversations and training people how to do that. And then, the fact that, pre-building coalitions so that you can handle things because you can't build that stuff in the moment. It's too crisis, it's too chaotic. And sort of having all those structures in place, I think that's, that is basic training for a democracy, right?
Yeah.
I think that was the whole de Tocqueville thing, like when he went around Americans, like, oh, Americans are always doing politics. They got these little groups everywhere and they're always figuring out their towns and their neighborhoods. And yeah, that's probably something we lost for our foundation.
Right. And like everybody always talks about what is the book Bowling Alone, right? Where it's like, oh, the problem is Americans aren't bowling anymore. And it's like, no, the problem is that they're not like organizing and talking about politics anymore. And like bowling was always kind of a proxy. Like, PTA, it's a proxy. Like there's a reason for people getting people together. Like, what do you talk about when you're together with other people? Like things that matter to you, right? And not just like, oh, did you see the TV show, whatever, it was fine. Like, I don't know. I think that all of us who care about politics are in a unique position to inject politics into everything in ways that show people that politics is pleasurable and enjoyable. It isn't all like eating your vegetables or whatever. Like politics is fun as hell. Like some of the most funs I've ever had is like when I'm like in a protest, like running from the police, right? It's like a scary, horrible time, but it's invigorating. And you meet wonderful people who end up like coming to your aid years later because you're on the same side of history, right? Like politics is about constructing the meaning of our lives. Without politics, like, let me put it this way. Politics is like, creates secular form of meaning that you can only otherwise get in religion. So if you're not a religious person, politics is what you got. And if you are a religious person, chances are you're already getting engaged in politics anyways. But even if you're not, like you should be.
Right.
It's fun.
Yeah, and I think that's why I was drawn to cultural studies, the community foundation aspect of cultural studies, and just the idea that, oh, a lot of things that I've been feeling, if I look back at the communities I've come through, it explains a lot, and it is that sense of these are not just arbitrary communities. They've been constructed by decisions that people have made, and you can participate in that. You can alter the community towards something where, that you think it should be. And so I think that empowers people in a way that you said, you don't have to be scared of politics. Politics is how you construct your world. So you want to be involved in that.
Right. Who do you want to build worlds with? How big can you build your world? Right. These are the sorts of things like I try to get my students to think about. It's like, look, you're in college. Like you can start like any organization or group you want. Like you can do pretty much anything you want, like within legal, whatever, like do it. Like the only thing that's stopping you from doing whatever you want to do in terms of organizing your life with other people is yourself and the law, right? And if the law isn't getting in your way, then what else is, right? I think that too many people, they think that politics is this like faraway thing and that it doesn't impact their lives in any kind of material way until it does, right? And it's like, if we see it instead as being something that infuses everything that we do, right? See the politics around us. It creates a different level of agency, like a different ability to engage, right? Where it's like, oh, I can engage in politics by just like calling a meeting, right? Of people who all think that this one thing is a bad idea or something. We don't have to like wait for someone else to do it or like join a political party or whatever. Don't get me wrong, like this is I would like more left people to organize than right people, right? Right people actually are pretty well organized. There's a lot of student groups, for example, and things like that are, nationally coordinated and funded in ways that create conservative and right-wing infrastructure at the grassroots. We don't really have that on the left. We need it desperately.
Yeah, I agree. That's one of the things I liked about Jen Senko's stuff, just looking at the organizational hierarchy behind the right, the media, and you're like, oh, it's been built since the Lowell Doctrine, and so it's been around. And so having an architecture of communication, there's an infrastructure to build the messages and disseminate them, along a fairly monologue structure. It's you watch and say, okay, I see why they're getting their message out. It's not just magic, it's an infrastructure. And so again, that's kind of why I like ultimately rhetoric. It's like, yeah, let me see the mechanisms. And if I want to interrupt the mechanisms, then I'll do that. If I want to build those mechanisms, then, I'll try to do that. Mm-hmm. Well, this has been great, man. You're very well spoken about this. I think the idea of coming from the left and coming from, sort of non-traditional groups and finding ways into, the larger culture in order to make, sort of adjustments. It's a fascinating thing. It's ongoing. And there's so many different aspects of it and so many different communities that have to do that kind of work. It's super fun to watch.
Yeah, I find politics invigorating. It's the only reason I wake up in the morning. So I hope other people can also feel invigorated by it and not as scared as they sometimes do.
Well, anything you want to promote before you get off? Anything you want people to go check out or?
I mean, I don't know. So I've got a book I co-edited with Anthony Nadler called News on the Right, which is out in 2019 and available from Oxford University Press or like whatever Amazon's, whatever bookstores you use online. I don't think there are in any actual bookstores. I've got another book I'm working on called Making the Liberal Media, which is a history of the idea of the liberal media. So it's like a history of conservative media activism and criticism. Going all the way back to the 1940s, more or less. That'll be coming out in a couple years, probably. I'm still working on it. Otherwise, keep an eye out. I don't know. Follow me on Twitter at AJ Bauer. That's pretty much it.
Awesome. Well, this has been super fun. I appreciate you jumping on. Again, sort of check out AJ's stuff. I think these ideas, the more they filter down into the grassroots of America, the healthier we'll be. Maybe we'll have so much cloud conflict up here if we get, you know, people more understanding of the process, you know, down at the actual lived experience. So this has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Thanks for tuning in. We will see you next time. Get out there, persuade people. As always, they need it.